Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's feature presentation, Driving Miss Daisy.
No, man. No.
Just what I'm talking about. It's turning the dim shit. I'm out of here, man. Hey, yo, check it out, man. I got Black C's at the crib, man. Y'all want to go check that out?
Yeah.
That's the idea. We could have rolled it from the get, y'all.
We are live from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. And we turn now to a project that tries to capture some of our region's African-American history before it's too late. On Sunday night, the audience cheered when this year's Oscar for Best Picture went to Green Book. But for some movie critics and fans, they had a less than rosy view of this film, which tells the story of the African-American experience of travel in the Jim Crow South through the eyes of a white driver. The North Carolina African-American Heritage Commission is giving the history of the Green Book a much more authentic treatment. It's a project called Green Books, Oasis Spaces, and it's collecting stories, artifacts, and oral histories from the people who experienced that era. Angela Thorpe is Associate Director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, and she's with us now. Angela, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Lisa Withers is a research historian working on the project. Welcome to you, Lisa. Thank you. Angela, tell us more about Green Books.
Absolutely. So I'll state by saying I'm acting director. I've been serving that role for just a few months now. But the Green Book, it is, if you've seen one, they're very rare, so it's incredible if you've seen one, but it is this small document. It's a little green book, kind of flimsy paper, and when you open it, you'll see a number of businesses from tourist homes to motels, in some cases hotels, tailors and restaurants that are listed by city and by state. And really, they are giving African Americans a sense of where they can find oasis as they travel about North Carolina, about North America, and in some cases beyond, as there were some overseas editions as well.
And this was vital in the Jim Crow period for not only travelers, vacationers, salespeople, also entertainers who were traveling the circuit, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Lisa, you've spoken with several people since the start of the project who had some pretty difficult experiences traveling in North Carolina. Give us a sense of what you're hearing as you move through our state and try to gather stories about the Green Book.
So we've had an opportunity to begin reaching out to community members and be able to hear what it was like to travel, and not only travel by car, but travel by various means of transportation. And really, it has definitely been an eye-opening for some of my generation to hear some of the experiences. For example, we had a community member in Lenoir County to talk about the first time she experienced the Ku Klux Klan. And it was an experience when she was driving at night. And she was driving. She was on her way. She was a student at North Carolina Central University. She was going away to her night shift at UNC Hospitals, and she was just passed by a car with people all dressed in white sheets. And it was an experience that really shocked her and shook her to a core, and she was willing to share that experience with us. We also have other community members who also talk about the dangers of driving at night, but also the dangers to drive during the day and different experiences. I've had one community member in Raleigh to talk about the experiences he had engagement with the police That, you know, there was a time when he was stopped by police. He had just gotten a car, brand new car, but he was stopped by the police, and the police accused him. It was keeping a noise, that's the way a community member put it. And so as we move across the state, we've had community members who have been willing to share with us a variety of different kinds of experiences that really highlight the need for such a publication like the Green Book.
Yeah, particularly some of those problems, sadly, are still with us today, mm-hmm. but finding a space, finding businesses that would be safe and an oasis was particularly challenging at that time. And as you say, you know, for people of this generation, obviously for people of that generation, it was the way of life, and it's slipping. And so collecting these oral histories seems very important. Here's a short piece of oral history that you collected from Sidney Jones, who remembers taking road trips with his parents.
We were actually, I think it just came through Virginia, coming into North Carolina, and it was early in the morning, and we stopped at a gas station. Back then, they called them filling stations because you would stop, and they would clean your windshield, check your oil, check your tires and stuff like that, and you know, gas you up. So we stopped at this one filling station, and I think I was probably 9 or 10, and a boy that came out to wait on us, he was about the same age. And my father, he got outside the car and was telling him what he wanted, you know, to fill it up or whatever. And the little boy said, is that all you need, boy? And yeah. And I was coming out of that car, and my mother pulled me back. Sit down, because I was coming. I said, no. And I was only like 10 years old. I said, this doesn't sound right. So, I mean, he was my age, and he said, is that all you want, boy? Yeah.
It was Sidney Jones speaking with my guest, research historian Lisa Withers. I'm also talking with Angela Thorpe, who is the acting director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, about the project Green Books, Oasis Spaces. Angela, give us a sense of this project, the scope of the project, and its goals.
Absolutely. So in the summer of 2017, the African American Heritage Commission was actually awarded a grant by the Institute of Museum and Library Services that is a federal agency that helps support museums, libraries, and cultural institutions across the country. And essentially, we were tasked with researching the 326 Green Book sites that were listed in the Green Book between 1936 and 1966, so the Jim Crow era. So we've been working diligently over the last year and some change to do that research, really with the work of Lisa Withers and a number of interns that we've brought along to help her work in the field. And ultimately, this public portion of the project is going to kick off exactly a year from now, in March 2020. It will include two identical traveling exhibits about the Green Book in North Carolina that will travel across the state of North Carolina. It will include an interactive web portal, and people will also have the opportunity to connect to the Green Book and legacies of African American travel in North Carolina and beyond through a series of public programs through 2020. So, again, we're really happy that Lisa has helped us enter this research phase very deeply, and we're excited to present this research in a number of mediums in the next year.
Lisa, Angela mentioned something like a 300-some sites that were in that book beginning in the 1930s. How many remain in the state of North Carolina?
So that is a number that we're currently tracking. At this time, we have discovered about 66 of the physical structures that still remain out of the 300 and some. And so, unfortunately, during the mid-20th century, our good friend, I mean friend in air quotes, urban renewal took out a lot of sites. If it wasn't urban renewal, it was something else. Like, for example, in Charlotte, anyone who goes to a Carolina Panthers football game, Bank of America Stadium is on top of at least four or five Green Book sites in the Charlotte area.
Tell us about gathering these stories now and you know, what happens when people are actually asked to recall them. Give us your experience.
So really the thing that I think is the most powerful about this project is bringing to attention of us all across the state and in our local communities of the importance of our local institutions. So for example, I've had an opportunity to talk to several community members, and when I ask them about certain businesses, they're like, oh yeah, I remember such and such restaurant. Like for example, there's a drive-up restaurant called the Now Congo in Raleigh. And I've had a few community members in Raleigh be like, oh, we remember Now Congo. It was great. You can get good chicken sandwiches. And they would describe the kind of foods that you could get there. And so there's oftentimes this happiness that comes in remembering the business, and also this joy of being able to say, like, you know, I remember this business, and it was important, not just in our local communities, but also nationally as well.
But this also recalls a very difficult time, a traumatic time, and it the does. Trauma that goes along with the mm-hmm. not-so-successful moment, Sydney's mm-hmm. story about having to restrain himself, be restrained. Mm-hmm. What about that aspect of it? What's the value overall of a project like this, do you think, Lisa? And then I'll ask Angela the same question.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the more traumatic elements of it, I think the value of it is that it forces us to deeply reconsider where we are in 2018. Because the situation that Mr. Jones recalled in the clip that we heard, unfortunately, is something that we still encounter today. It may not be an attendant saying, you know, what do you want, boy? But oftentimes looks, stares, questions such as, you know, are you sure I can help you? Are you in the right place? You know, and so instances such as that. And community members, while, yes, I mentioned that there's oftentimes a period of, you know, remembering certain community institutions, if you will, there is time where there have been tough conversations of remembering, because there is a lot of pain associated with this time and with this story. And so I think, you know, work with community members, part of the importance of this project is remembering the entire aspect of that era and remembering what work still needs to be done.
Mm. And Angela, you're also collecting artifacts as well that go along with this?
Absolutely. So that is something that we are seeking help from the community around. So again, in about a year from now, we're going to have these traveling exhibits that go across the state. And I don't think that there's anything that really can communicate a story better than an object. I'm trained in public history, museum studies, and so, again, I really love using objects to tell stories. And so we're fortunate that we have one original green book that was loaned to the project for the purposes of traveling the state, but we're looking for other artifacts, including ads, green books, and other objects from green book businesses to help more fully tell the story of the Green Book of North Carolina and really connect people tangibly to this concept of seeking oasis, even as you try to move around your own community and your own state.
Angela Thorpe is acting director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission. Lisa Withers, a research historian who is also working with the project. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
The Monday after the Oscars is full of red carpet recaps, Twitter threads, and think pieces, and occasionally some big snub or snafu that has everybody talking. Last night, it was a surprise win in the final category, Best Picture.
And the Oscar goes to Green Book.
Many film critics criticized that decision, and so did director Spike Lee. His film Black Klansman was also in the running for Best Picture last night. 30 years ago, his film Do the Right Thing didn't get a nomination the year the Best Picture Oscar went to Driving Miss Daisy. Here's what Spike Lee said to reporters after the ceremony.
I'm snake bit. I mean, every time somebody's driving somebody, I lose.
Twice, a story of racial reconciliation told through a white person's perspective, one in a year that Lee offered a much sharper critique of race in America. For more, we have reached film and TV critic Rebecca Theodore Vachon. She has written for The New York Times and Forbes, among others. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you heard Julia Roberts say those words, Green Book?
I actually wasn't surprised. I had tweeted earlier a few hours before the broadcast for people to prepare themselves for the fact that Green Book could, in fact, win Best Picture, and it did.
put this into context for us in the broader picture of last night's Oscars, because the winners included Regina King, Rami Malek, Alfonso Cuarón, Spike Lee, a group of people from very different backgrounds representing films that tell nuanced stories about diverse experiences. And then the top honor is given to a film that many people have criticized for being an overly simplistic story about race told from the perspective of a white savior. So how do you put that one award into the broader context of the entire Oscars ceremony last night?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, as far as the acting wins for major categories, we had three people of color. So there's definitely been some gains as far as the representation of people of color winning. But as far as Green Book, I think this is a reflection of the type of movies people want to see when it comes to racism or racial conciliation. Green Book is a feel-good movie. It doesn't really require a lot of critical thinking or self-analysis. You know, people walk out of the movie feeling that, oh, well, racism is over. We're good. So I think those are the things that are going on.
History was made in other ways last night, too. Hannah Beechler won for production design. Ruth Carter won for costume design. Both of them worked on the movie Black Panther. They were the first African-American women to win Oscars in those categories. In fact, only one other African-American woman in history has won in a non-acting category. Do those breakthroughs in any way balance your disappointment at the final award given out last night?
Well, for me, it balances it out. Like I said, I pretty much expected Green Book to win, so I pretty much made peace with that. But I do feel that the wins for Ruth Carter and Hannah Beechler were especially significant, having two black women winning in non-acting categories. And I feel that, you know, Hannah's acceptance speech was so beautiful and really highlighted the importance of how male creatives, Ryan Coogler, who is the director of Black Panther, hired both Hannah and Ruth to do the costume design and the production design. And it really opens up a larger conversation of how, you know, I see it as a call of action. We have, you know, Ryan Coogler, Barry Jenkins, who has been, you know, a very vocal advocate for women directors and for black women behind the camera and in front of the camera, as well as Jordan Peele. These three black creatives are using their platform and using their influence to really give black women and women in general opportunities. And I think that is very important. I think that's something that a conversation that definitely needs to go past the Oscar wins.
There's a long history of the Oscars giving the Best Picture Award to a movie that in hindsight, consensus says was probably the wrong pick. So if that turns out to be the case with the 2019 Oscars, can people just kind of shrug and say, well, that's what the Oscars do. They pick a movie that a few years later everybody thinks was the wrong one.
Right. I mean, because it's all subjective, right? I mean, the movies that we love, the movies that we hate. I mean, I know there were a lot of people that were rooting for A Star is Born. There were people that were rooting for Bohemian Rhapsody. And, you know, this happens every year with the Oscars, whichever, you know, picture wins Best Picture. There are always people who will feel that the movie that they love should have won. But yeah, we'll have to see. I think time will tell. History will show if Green Book was in fact the correct pick for Best Picture.
That's film and TV critic Rebecca Theodore-Vachon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Decades ago, I said that, you know, I didn't know much about Brazil, still don't. But from what I heard from people who had been there, or people who were from there, because I'd heard a long time ago that outside of Africa, the largest population of black people is in Brazil. But you don't ever see them on television, even on the Brazilian programs. It's every now and then, I mean, somebody will pan the camera, and you'll spot them on the at Mardi Gras time. But where are they the rest of the time when they make the advertisements and do all the hoopla and whatnot? You wouldn't think that is, you know, it was just, you would think that there's just a smattering of black people in Brazil. I mean, when I say black people, the black people that look like black people in Central Africa. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are huge. But they all push back up in those hills. But when it comes to classification, from what I understand, Brazilians will tell you, we don't have any discrimination here. You know, everybody's the same. Color don't make no difference here. This is Brazil.
We head now to Brazil. atual presidente hoje do Brasil prometeu várias coisas, e na campanha dele mesmo ele...
The current president of Brazil promised several things. Throughout his campaign, he complained that indigenous lands were too big and that he wouldn't demarcate even 1 centimeter of indigenous land. Now, indigenous lands in Brazil are very vulnerable for invaders to enter and feel at ease.
Biteche is a member of the Uruwaiwawau, an indigenous tribe living in Brazil's Odoanya state. Once home to a natural landscape almost the size of Kansas, over the past 3 decades, Odoanya has seen more than 30% of its trees cut down. It is now one of the most deforested areas of the Amazon. Advocates like Kleber Bursato, Secretary General of Brazil's Indigenous Missionary Council, are concerned that the crisis is only getting worse under Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro.
We are very worried because indicators suggest that in Brazil there is currently a new phase of illegal invasions and occupations of indigenous lands that is underway.
Sam Cowie is an independent journalist based in Sao Paulo, and he explains that this is an escalation of a long, troubled relationship between Brazil and its indigenous citizens.
It was at the beginning of the 20th century the first government body was founded to protect indigenous people. This was called the Serviço Proteção do Índio, the Indigenous Protection Service. This was replaced by the National Indigenous Foundation in 1967 after there were lots of reports of abuses committed against indigenous people, that, you know, they were shot at on their lands, that smallpox and other diseases were purposefully introduced to these tribes, basically to clear the land to make way for large infrastructure projects. Now, this happened throughout Brazil's military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985, where it's estimated that something like 8,500 indigenous people were killed or died of diseases. All indigenous lands were supposed to be fully demarcated and protected as of 1995 under the post-dictatorship constitution, which says that indigenous people have the exclusive rights to their lands. But if we look at Brazil today, we still see many indigenous lands that are not fully protected. And what we've seen, especially since 2015, really, when Brazil really fell into economic and political crisis, we've seen the situation getting worse.
What about Brazil now has a new president and Jair Bolsonaro. What's his take and his relationship with the indigenous community?
Well, Mr. Bolsonaro is a former military man. He served in the army during the military dictatorship. He was a captain. He was a paratrooper. Mr. Bolsonaro has always had a very, very antagonist stance against indigenous people, according to indigenous advocates. It's very much like the military dictatorship's position, which is, you know, forced integration, that these people are just the same as us. We're all Brazilians. One of the things he tweeted after becoming president was that indigenous lands, there's less than 1 million indigenous people who live on 12% of Brazilian territories. He's long had, you know, a very anti-indigenous stance in Congress, saying that, you know, their lands are too big, they need to be reduced. Who needs protection in Brazil is farmers and producers. And now that he's the president of Brazil, advocacy groups and indigenous people themselves say they are feeling the heat from increased aggressions against them, which they believe is caused by a mixture of Mr. Bolsonaro's very inflammatory rhetoric combined with serious cuts to indigenous protection bodies and environmental agencies.
What is the goal of doing that for the military or for the Brazilian government? I mean, what ultimately are they trying to take back land? Are they trying to control a population? What exactly is the goal? Because there is an NGO that found that at least 14 groups, indigenous groups and territories, were currently under attack in this way.
Yeah, I mean, they're under attack by criminals, basically. These aren't agents of the state. Loggers and land grabbers, you know, in the Brazilian Amazon. What basically happens is that first you go in and you take the wood, and then once the wood's been removed, then you clear the rest of the area, and then you plant some grass, and you raise cattle on it, and then you try to sell the area over and over again. It's a land grabbing scheme called grilaging. Advocacy groups say that these criminals are in fact feeling incentivized and encouraged by Bolsonaro's rhetoric that, you know, a pretty much anything goes policy is going now.
Sam, can we talk a little bit about the racial and economic element here? I mean, this is obviously, these are communities of color also.
Yeah, absolutely. They're indigenous Brazilians, of course. You know, they are the most marginalized group in Brazil. Brazil is a country that has more than 60,000 homicides a year. About 70% to 75% of those victims are young black men between the ages of 15 and 30. Now, of course, indigenous people in Brazil make up something like a 0.5% of the population. So they are also very vulnerable in the fact that they don't really have much representation in Congress. The first congresswoman from an indigenous background was elected this year to the state of Roraima in the Amazon. Mr. Bolsonaro said that Roraima state in itself, which is home to lots of indigenous people, it's a very mining-rich state, and he believes that lots of mining wealth is hidden under these indigenous territories. And in fact, one of the things he campaigned on was to open up indigenous territories to mining interests and also agricultural interests.
Sam, what type of environmental impact would that have?
We know that the Amazon is already about 15 to 17% deforested. You know, very specialized leading climate experts, they say that, you know, if this deforestation rate reaches more than between 20 and 25%, then the Amazon could reach a point where of no return, basically. Indigenous lands in Brazil, especially in the Amazon, they concentrate some of the best preserved forests in the country. And that's a real buffer to climate change.
And is the United States in any way involved in this? We know that President Trump has supported Bolsonaro so far.
Perhaps not directly, but definitely, you could say, indirectly through Mr. Trump's support for Bolsonaro and for the lack of regulations often applied to Brazilian products, especially timber, that head to the United States and are consumed in the United States.
Sam Cowie is an independent journalist based in Sao Paulo. Sam, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks very much.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
This is from Saturday at a semi-pro hockey game in Saint-Jérôme near Montreal. Fans yelling racist slurs at Jonathan Diaby, who is black, one even leaning over the side of the penalty box to taunt him. And it didn't stop there. Fans turned on Diaby's father and girlfriend, who were in the stands, insulting and threatening them as well. Our Allison Northcott now with the story behind the video and the outrage it sparked.
I had to put my jersey over my face because I had teardrops, you know?
Jonathan Diaby says he's faced racism before, but nothing like this.
They started yelling racist stuff at my parents and my sister and all that, and myself. Good old Negro and all that, the baboons, like a bunch of stuff that was said.
The insults, he says, came from a handful of spectators and were so bad he and his family left the arena before the game was over.
Well, my dad was told to go back home, that he had no business in his country and all the places and stuff like that. People were like touching his hair. They were making fun of him. My sister was scared. My girlfriend was scared.
He says referees and security guards did nothing to protect them. Diaby's league, the Ligue Nord-Américaine de Hockey, is notorious for rough play and rowdy crowds. But Diaby's coach says even by that standard, this goes too far.
In 2019, it's something that, you know, we shouldn't see anymore. And it's, I think it's disgusting.
Je tiens à m'excuser.
The head of the league apologized to Diaby in this video, telling fans that racist, sexist, or homophobic comments are unacceptable. An owner of the opposing team says security guards did act, but didn't kick anyone out because no one threw any punches. Now, Robert Chevrier says the team is trying to identify the fans in question to ban them from future games.
C'est un très bon point.
Former NHL player Georges Larrac says there should be a rule across the league requiring teams to kick fans out who engage in this kind of behavior.
This is worst thing that I've ever seen. When I started to play hockey and I've lived some racism when I played hockey, it was never to that level.
This is not hockey, you know, like that's a That's far beyond like what should be happening in on a regular Saturday night. You know, nobody should be feel threatened to go watch his son play a hockey game.
Diaby says it's also up to players to tell their fans that hate is not okay in the stands or anywhere else. Alison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
What was your reaction when you heard about what happened to Jonathan Diaby?
I was pretty surprised when I heard what happened, because 30 years ago I went through similar stuff. But I would think that 30 years later, the society would evolve and you wouldn't see that type of stuff. And it got into another level because he didn't just get racial slur yelled at him, but his family got threatened also in the stands, and it got out of hand. He was on the ice and he had to leave the game to get his family out of there. And that's why when you learn that stuff, that it went to this magnitude, you just can't believe it.
Well, I mean, the thing that struck me about the story was at one point he was in the penalty box. He was next to a teammate, and he had to put his sweater up to not let the tears be public because he started to cry. Now, you guys are tough guys. I've never heard about a hockey player coming to tears or a black athlete coming to tears that publicly. That was what's totally shocking and horrifying to me, that he was hurt that badly.
Well, the thing is that I've talked to him many times, and it wasn't just what happened to him. You saw people harassing his dad where he was sitting. And, you know, when people go after your family, this is another level. Because we could always take care of ourselves. We're pretty used to this type of behaviors. You know, we know if you're black, you decide to play hockey, you will have to fight through some of that stuff, unfortunately. But to see your parents going through this while you're watching, powerless, that's where there's a line. There's a line for everything, and there's nothing better. There's no situation in any ways that is good and acceptable. But, man, when he saw his family and his girlfriend already getting harassed, it just got to the point that it was too much.
You know, it's kind of crazy. This is Canada's dirty little secret, I've always felt, because, you know, we pass ourselves off on the world stage as like really calm, cool and collected people. But we go nuts whenever hockey's involved. And no one knows that more than you. I mean, you played it for a long time and now you talk about it. What is that about, do you think?
Well, first, it's important to say that we're talking about a minority of people. Because the majority of people are good, you know, like, and there's been a lot of love that has been sent to Jonathan that went through this. So I don't want to say that everybody is like this and it's a major global problem with hockey. You know, yes, people are passionate about hockey, but at the same time, we know that because there's not a lot of minority that plays hockey, because the minority that plays stands out more, there's more remarks. But if you play soccer, basketball, or the other sport, it's not the case. So we know this is something that comes with the job. But at the end of the day, you know, whether hockey is popular in Canada or not, there's no reason for racism. Like, there's no reason for people that are sexist or people that are homophobic or that stuff. Equality for human being is all the same in my eyes. And it's important to enforce rules that will make sure that everybody's respected equally.
Have you managed to talk to Jonathan yet?
Yeah, many times. Yeah, we've talked many times about what happened, and I congratulate him on being able to stay calm, grab his family, and leave. Because I told him that if it would have been me, I probably would have been in jail today. Because I would not react calmly if I see my dad, my parent, and my family getting harassed in the stand. So you know, I talked about it. I was showing support and sympathizing with him because I went through the same thing. I can understand. So, yeah. And then we're talking about doing an event, doing something to help sensibilize people, you know, in the region. So we're going to do something in the future.
Okay. Thanks for your time. And as always, thank you for the example that you've set for the rest of us, just on how one conducts himself with class at all times. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Bye for now.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave.
Don't tell me that I'm a free person and I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know. And you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving. Boy, I'm really working out now. I mean, boy, the sweat is flying, whatnot, and I'm behind that mule, and I'm grinning. I'm a business associate at the Bodie Plantation. Man, I feel great. Get up, mule.
So you, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, you don't see
word masters. See what I mean?
Liberty was the clarion call of the American Revolution, but as cynics in Great Britain pointed out at the time, the loudest voices for freedom came from men who owned slaves. Some African Americans won their liberty by fighting for the colonies, but many more took a very different path to freedom, by joining the British. Records of slaves joining the British Army are few, but historian Todd Braisted has just published an article documenting the life of one such man, a South Carolina teenager known originally as Barney. Tell us first about Barney. How old was he when he joined the British Army?
He was around 17 years old. There are some documents that we are aware of through a British officer named John Graves Simcoe. He took some prisoners from a Continental Artillery unit that had several young slaves in uniform, and he claimed them for the British, apparently Barney being one of them.
So Barney didn't necessarily join the British Army. He was forced to be in it.
He was given an opportunity that he did not relinquish. We'll put it that way. But we know enough that Barney certainly embraced the opportunity as more or less somebody who could fight for his freedom.
How unusual was it for African Americans to actually become fighting men for the British Army during the Revolutionary War?
Well, fighting is a subjective word. Unfortunately, for the British Army, there was a prohibition on blacks actually bearing arms. They couldn't enlist as regular soldiers. So Barney, his future as a fighting man was somewhat limited. By joining Simcoe's unit, the Queen's Rangers, he could, however, serve as a trumpeter. Everyone who's seen cavalry movies, you know, knows that they have a trumpeter sounding the charge and all those sorts of things. Well, that's what Barney became. He had a sword. He probably had a pistol or two. So he could fight in that capacity.
So the British promised African Americans freedom but wouldn't let them bear arms?
Correct. They served in many other capacities. The British put them into what was called the civil branches of the army, all the support branches, the commissary general's department, the wagon master general's department. There were opportunities, but you know, if you're looking for a red coat on a black soldier, it would not be a common sight.
And what do we know about Barney's military career?
Barney served in the Queen's Rangers through the end of the war. He earned the favor of his commander, Simcoe, at a battle on June 26, 1781, near Williamsburg, Virginia. And Barney, his troop, was almost surprised. Barney had the presence of mind, however, to lead the American cavalry away from the surprised Loyalist troops, giving them a chance to mount up and take action. So Simcoe commended him for that. But Barney then charged and dismounted and attacked a Continental Army lieutenant and took him prisoner. Barney then saved the life of his troop commander, Captain David Schenck, from near death in the ensuing melee. Barney himself was wounded in the action and dismounted, but not captured. All these things are quite unusual, certainly for any member, black or white, back then.
I wanted to get to the end of the war because, as we all know, the British lost. What happened to Barney at the end of the war?
Barney sort of disappears from the record book once he is in England. If it was not for Simcoe's request to the War Office, there would be no trace of him.
But interestingly, Barney's service for the British Army was rewarded financially.
Correct. As a wounded soldier, Barney was actually eligible for what was called the Chelsea Pension. So he could go and collect money for his support for the rest of his life. which was something not afforded to all British soldiers. You had to basically earn it.
Todd Braisted's article on the life of trumpeter Bernard Barney Griffiths appeared this month in the Journal of the American Revolution. Thanks a lot, Todd.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Don't touch my hair.
Targeting someone because of their dreadlocks, cornrows, or other hairstyle can now lead to steep fines in New York City. Among other things, employers there can no longer force workers to straighten their hair to promote a certain corporate image. The new guidelines apply to everyone, but they're specifically meant to protect Black people who often face discrimination because of their hair. Oluwakeme Aladisui visited a couple of New York City hair salons to learn what people there think of the new protections.
Hair has often been a battleground.
I used to have to get my hair hot combed.
When Ayanna Huggins was younger, she went through great lengths to get her naturally kinky hair to be straight.
That was like torture. A hot comb, that you literally put that on the stove and heat it up, and then they comb through your hair. You could hear it like sizzling. Like, oh, the worst, the worst.
Today, she's got dreadlocks that go past her shoulders.
Growing up, straighter hair seemed like the most acceptable hair instead of our natural, kinky, curly hair, which is also beautiful.
She's sitting in a salon chair at Sabine's hallway, waiting to get her new growth interlocked. It's Saturday morning, and the salon is busy. There are women with platinum coils and orange-tipped twists. Someone is getting her hair blown dry so that it floats up around her face like a cloud. It's people like these that New York City's new guidelines are meant to protect. Now, forcing people to change their hairstyle for work, school, and in other public places can amount to racial discrimination. Many Black people have long dealt with racial stereotypes about hair. Huggins says that if she worked in corporate America, she'd worry that her locks would be seen as unprofessional.
This idea of like women as delicate with long hair that's straight. And I think like everyone falls into that, not just like Black women.
Jade Allenby is getting her locks freshened. When she was in law school, Allenby worried about how other people would perceive her hair. So she spent months combing out her dreadlocks so she could wear her hair straight for job interviews.
I think though that for Black women it becomes like incredibly contentious. Just because we have to go through extreme lengths to kind of manipulate our hair to be straight. So it's like, it's a chemical process. It's like a physical process.
At Deluxe Gallery in Fort Greene, reggae hums in the background, and a similar conversation is taking place.
To say that somebody has to straighten their hair to attend or be a part of anything, to make that a requirement, is to deny them as a person.
That's Monique Jones. Her son has long, loose curls. When her grandmother saw the texture, she had this to say.
She said, I hope he keeps this. And it was just the sense that if his hair was to kink up, that it wouldn't be as acceptable or attractive.
The New York City guidelines attempt to protect people from discrimination. But the owner of Deluxe Gallery, Glenn Etienne, says it might not be enough. Especially when people are applying for jobs.
When you walk in for the interview and they see you have a certain hairstyle, they're going to find some reason to not hire you. Discrimination is not going to end here in America.
While they may not end discrimination based on hairstyle, other stylists at Deluxe hope that the New York City guidelines will give their clients the confidence and the freedom to choose whatever hairstyle they want. For NPR News, I'm Oluwakemi Aladisui in Brooklyn, New York.
Carrie. Back to old Virginia, there's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart and long to go.
Virginia First Lady Pamela Northam under fire tonight after handing out cotton to African-American students during a mansion tour.
Our Matthew Foltz joins us live tonight to tell us what happened and how Northam is responding. Matthew?
Well, Bill, Candace, a student from that tour wrote a letter to First Lady Northam that was obtained by CBS News. And in that letter, she tells First Lady the interaction was, quote, beyond inappropriate. Now, all of this happened while Governor Ralph Northam and his wife met with teenage students also known as Pages, on February 21st, just days before the legislative session ended. During the tour, they entered a cottage next to the garden that served as a workplace and kitchen for slaves who worked at the mansion. The First Lady discussed the historical significance with the students. According to the letter sent in by the student, it reads, quote, "When in the cottage house, you were speaking about cotton and how the slaves had to pick it. There are only three black pages in the page class of 2019. When you went to hand out the cotton, you handed it straight to another African-American page. Then you proceeded to hand it to me. I did not take it," end quote. The student also went on to say the episode was especially inappropriate considering recent events with the governor. He has also been resisting calls to step down for weeks after a racist photo on his medical school yearbook surfaced earlier this month, and he admitted to darkening his face on another occasion in 1984. Now, the First Lady sent CBS 6 a statement today apologizing for upsetting anyone. Quote, "I have provided the same educational tour to Executive Mansion visitors over the last few months and used a variety of artifacts and agricultural crops with the intention of illustrating a painful period of Virginia history. I regret that I have upset anyone," end quote. Now, a spokeswoman for Northam strongly denied the fact that First Lady singled out any black pages during that tour, and we have that full letter and statement online for you to look at right now at WTVR.com. Working for you tonight at the state capitol, Matthew Foltz, CBS 6 News.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today, "The Trump Effect." See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. "The Trump Effect and How It Spreads." It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Last Friday, the U.S. Coast Guard reported that it detained Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan after discovering what amounted to a planned terrorist plot, including an intent to kill journalists and prominent Democratic members of Congress. Hassan amassed a stockpile of some 15 weapons and left an extensive online trail affirming his commitment to white nationalism and his desire to incite a race war. The thwarted attack fits in with the disturbing rise in domestic extremism, and it raises even more questions about whether past and current military members are more susceptible to this type of radicalization. Joining us now is Janet Reitman, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone, and she's also working on an upcoming book on white supremacy. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when we look at this specific incident, what does this tell you about how the military deals or doesn't deal with domestic terrorism in its own ranks?
I mean, I think that it's worthwhile pointing out that, you know, my understanding is the Coast Guard did, in fact, look into this and was alerted to this early. You know, so that's encouraging. But it's important to point out that the military has a rule that allegedly is supposed to bar anyone who belongs to gangs, which would include white supremacist-type gangs, skinhead gangs, from joining. So if you have a swastika tattoo, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. If you, you know, have a history of being a part of a skinhead gang, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. This guy Hassan, he actually had been a skinhead like 30 years ago, according to his own letters.
Well, but despite all that, in 2017, there was a Military Times study that found that 25%, so one quarter of service members, had been at least exposed to white nationalism while serving in the military.
Yeah.
Is there something about military culture that draws these types of extremists?
I mean, military culture is, I would say that, you know, first of all, this 25% number, which I have also used and take seriously, that's not to say that one quarter of the U.S. military happen to be white nationalists. And I think that's often, you know, interpreted in that way, that statistic. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I don't have any evidence that that's the case. But what I do think is that the white supremacist movement for years and years and years has encouraged people to join the U.S. military to get training for the upcoming racial holy war, right? This is, you know, their training for what they anticipate will be their great conflict. So that is, you know, certainly something that's been true for, you know, really for decades.
And what you're describing, again, sounds similar to a lot of the radical Islamic groups that we talk about.
Yeah,
but the narrative here often isn't the same, right? The way we describe these groups often in the United States isn't the same. But
yeah.
you're describing something that's almost the holy war image that comes into mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that both, you know, Islamic extremist groups like ISIS and far-right extremist groups or far-right extremist individuals, they have many of the same fundamental drivers and recruit in many of the same ways and in many of the same venues and appeal to young people using many of the same methods and are treated absolutely diametrically differently. I mean, it's just, there is an absolute polar difference between the way these two groups of people are treated. If this had been a darker-skinned individual, if this had been an African-American or, you know, a Muslim-American member of the U.S. military who was planning an act of domestic terror and had those weapons and was and had all of those same points, all of those same data points were
and
true.
And a detailed list. Of
and a detailed list. That
targets.
Whole thing of it. If all those data points were the same, but this was a this happened to be a guy from a Sunni Muslim background, forget it, man. This would, you know how many journalists would be on this case? I mean, I reported on the Boston bombing, and I can tell you the competition, you know, and that was obviously an act of terror.
So what happened? Where was the media?
I have no idea. I mean, I was, it's, you know, same thing. Like it was, you know, people that covered, you know, extremism and terrorism were freaking out about this. You know, so particularly the journalists in the national security community all understood this was like a major deal. And, you know, the story has died. This thing about Jussie Smollett,
mm-hmm.
like that, that's the story that was above the fold, right? And so it's baffling, not surprising, but it still kind of just boggles the mind that
and it's fallen off. I mean,
yeah, it's fallen
yeah.
off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, you know, okay, what's going on with the case right now is there is a 2-week period during which investigators basically have to get more evidence of his being a national security threat. And there's been this big push right now.
Wait, let me just pause mm-hmm. right there because wait, if I have a weapons stockpile at home and I am trained in how to use those weapons, and I am, or, you know, whatever we want to call them, firearms, what have you, and I have a list of people who I want to kill with those firearms, at what point am I not a national security threat?
I mean, that, well, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But they, I mean, they have him on these weapons and drug charges, and I think they need to, I mean, I don't, the rationale was we will hold him for 2 weeks. And see what you can give us in 2 weeks.
Can we let's talk more specifically, even because we talked about the media, we talked about the way we sort of look at this, but the we here, is there a connection between the rhetoric that we've heard for the past 2 years? And I'm not suggesting that racism and white supremacy and white nationalism suddenly, you know, came about in 2016. That's not the case. That's our country has often been, you know, that's rooted in our country. But has the rhetoric, has the openness of white nationalism, this sort of resurgence of it so openly contributed to what we're seeing today?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, you know, the role of technology, which everybody points out, but, you know, Twitter and Gab and these platforms, it's not only that there are online platforms, it's that there are a lot of them and they continue to just pop up when one goes away. But I do think that this, you know, the rhetoric that came out of the 2016 presidential campaign and the whole emergence of Donald Trump and the way that he has played to a certain base has, absolutely contributed to this. And you see that, you know, for example, you see in this guy, one of his little points was that he was researching was, you know, civil war if Trump is impeached. I mean, there's a lot of linking this president to larger white nationalist agendas, even though, in fact, many white nationalists and neo-Nazis do not actually see Donald Trump as one of them. He is a tool for them. He did not create them. They think that they would judge him harshly because he has a Jewish son-in-law and his daughter converted to Judaism. And all of a sudden, you see these white nationalist types being like, wait a minute, he's saying what we've been saying for years. Like, so great. Let's let him keep saying it. I mean, seriously, he's empowered their rhetoric in a way that I don't think they would have ever imagined.
Janet Reitman is a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. She's currently working on a book about white supremacy post 9/11. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, it's the same way that all, you know, a whole bunch of white people now have gone on Indian reservations and they're running their casinos and calling themselves Indians. They just put on some feathers and that's it.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of listeners, they've been saying they think the same thing is going to happen if there are ever any reparations or compensation for a
state. Oh, man, they would clean up.
Yep.
That's how they got on the Indian reservations. All that money would go directly to white people.
Yep. They said it would be white people out of the bushes. Like, what? Wait a minute, I got a black grandma.
They wouldn't be saying they got a black nothing. They'd be saying I'm black, you know. I mean, white people with brown hair and blue eyes, we talking about they the second cousin to Stephen Fetcher. Think nothing of it.
Now let's hear some of the Democrats who would like to replace President Trump. Some are being asked a provocative question. What do you think of reparations? That means payments to African Americans for slavery at the start of this country and for official discrimination afterward. Some Democrats say they favor the idea, but it's harder to say how reparations would be paid. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
At a CNN town hall this week, Bernie Sanders was asked about the topic of reparations. When moderator Wolf Blitzer pushed him for a direct response, Sanders answered with his own question, one that is now hanging over the 2020 Democratic field.
So what is your position specifically on reparations? I asked the question because Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro, they've indicated they want to support.
What does that mean? What do they mean? I'm not sure that anyone's very clear.
Warren, Castro, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, California Senator Kamala Harris, and author Marianne Williamson have all in some way said they are in favor of reparations for African Americans. Warren has added that Native Americans should be a part of the conversation as well. But as far as what their reparations would look like, or how reparations is even defined, that's where things get complicated. Williamson has the most straightforward approach, saying she'd allocate up to $500 billion to reparations. Harris, meanwhile, has said that she approves of reparations and has promoted her tax credit plan when asked about what types of policies she'd put into place.
We have to recognize that everybody did not start out on an equal footing in this country. And in particular, black people have not. And so we have got to recognize that and do something about that and give folks a lift up.
Advocates for reparations point to America's massive racial wealth gap. As of 2016, the median white family had a net worth 10 times as big as the median black family. To address that, Booker is touting his baby bonds proposal, in which the government puts money into savings accounts for kids. That policy could substantially shrink the wealth gap, as African Americans are disproportionately on the low end of the income scale. However, neither Booker nor Harris's programs are race-based. All of this risks creating confusion around what exactly constitutes reparations, says Derek Hamilton, director of Ohio State's Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity.
Something that is economically inclusive but has a racial bent to it simply because of how one group is distributed along the income distribution, those may or may not be good policies. But let's be clear, it's not reparations.
Hamilton says that calling a policy reparations when it doesn't explicitly attempt to address past wrongs could amount to putting a Band-Aid on a gaping centuries-old wound.
That would be almost a worst-case scenario to say we have addressed the race issue when, in fact, we have not done it.
While the candidates' policies may not meet the criteria of reparations, they are being sold as racially conscious. For example, Warren's plan for housing aid, particularly to areas with a history of racial discrimination, could help shrink the wealth gap. But her campaign stresses that she does not consider that proposal reparations. Regardless of labels, the focus on racial disparities is a shift, according to Hillary Shelton, director of the NAACP's Washington Bureau.
What they're all recognizing is that these disparities are very much part of the American landscape. And finding solutions to them, I mean, addressing issues that are as broad as living in our country itself.
A 2016 Marist poll showed that only 1 in 4 Americans approved of reparations, but a clear majority of Black Americans backed the idea. That group is a key demographic for Democrats. And heading into 2020, the party is grappling with more direct questions about race and who its platform serves. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood.
Now, we are just days away from an explosive documentary on the late singer Michael Jackson being aired in the United States. Leaving Neverland features two men, now in their 30s and 40s, who say they were abused hundreds of times as children when they stayed at the Neverland Ranch in California back in the 80s and 90s. The men say they were sworn to secrecy at the time.
He told me if they ever found out what we were doing, he and I would go to jail for the rest of our lives.
Secrets will eat you up. You feel so alone.
I want to be able to speak the truth as loud as I had to speak the lie.
Leaving Neverland will be broadcast in the UK next week. The singer's family deny the claims and accuse the men of being opportunists. Vincent Dowd told me more about the documentary.
Well, very briefly, it's a two-part, roughly four-hour documentary. It'll be on HBO in the States this Sunday evening and Monday evening. It will also be seen in many other countries around the world. In the UK, for instance, it's on Channel 4 TV next week. It's a work, actually, of a British filmmaker, Dan Reed, whose background is very much in hard documentaries on crime, terrorism. I should make it absolutely clear I haven't yet seen the whole film, but clips have been released. The core is basically the testimony of two men, who we just heard very briefly, Wade Robson, who's now 36, and James Safechuck, who's now 40. It features those two men setting out in detail, I have to say, allegations of how they were individually sexually abused by Michael Jackson when they were children. He, of course, in his lifetime, absolutely denied all such charges.
And they've been speaking to the press ahead of the documentary this weekend, and Michael Jackson's family have been talking to the press as well, haven't they?
That's right. The Jackson estate is currently actually suing HBO for $100 million. They say the company has broken a clause in an old contract containing what they call a non-disparagement clause. But more specifically, the family are saying that the film, which they appear not to have seen, as far as we can work out, makes entirely unjustified charges. His brothers Marlon and Jackie spoke to CBS television.
This documentary is not telling the truth. There has not been not one piece of evidence that corroborates their story.
Shouldn't you see the documentary,
I don't
Jackie?
Care to say no. I don't have to see that documentary. I know my brother. I know what he stood for, what he was all about, bringing the world together, making kids happy.
So the family insistent these very serious charges of child abuse were totally unfounded, as the singer always claimed in his lifetime. The programme is on air this weekend in America. I think we'll be hearing a lot more about Michael Jackson before then and afterwards.
Vincent Dowd.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood.
Albert Woodfox joins us now from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans, and I want to ask him to read a paragraph from the new book that he's written with Leslie George. It's called Solitary. Mr. Woodfox.
I pace the cell to think. I pace to relieve tension. I lightly box the walls. My knuckles have calluses on them from boxing the wall. I do push-ups on my fists. I don't have deep thoughts. I'm practical. I get through the day the way I have done 1,000 times. Will this be the day I break? I push that thought away. Mind over matter. I keep moving so later I can sleep sometimes.
Albert Woodfox served more than 40 years in solitary confinement. in Louisiana's Angola prison for a crime he says he didn't commit, the murder of corrections officer Brent Miller. Mr. Woodfox was already serving time at Angola for armed robbery and believes he and another inmate were set up because of their prison activism as members of the Black Panther Party. His conviction for Brent Miller's murder was overturned twice, each time the state indicted him again. He was finally set free in 2016 after a plea deal to lesser charges. Albert Woodfox says the self-discipline instilled in him by his mother helped him through those decades alone in his cell.
I spent a lot of time reading, writing, self-education. I used the time to teach myself both criminal and civil law. And we lived on what we call an organized tier, along the principles of the Black Panther Party, developing unity among the guys on the tier. We taught guys how to read and write, which, you know, I think was my greatest achievement.
Mr. Woodfox, how often were you gassed?
Oh, my goodness. Well, gas was a standard form of weapons that the security people use. So anytime you challenge inhumane treatment or you challenge unconstitutional conduct, they would gas you, you know. And depending on the severity of the confrontation, they would open up your cell and they would come in and beat you down and then, you know, shackle you and bring you to the dungeon. And you probably would stay there a minimum of 10 days. The fact that I was involved in organizing a lot of protests against, you know, along with Herman and Robert.
Friends of yours, fellow inmates who were in at the same time.
Yeah, the other two men that made up what's called the Angola Three. They made it very possible for me to survive decades in solitary confinement. And not just survive, but, you know, to develop myself into a better person, a better human being, a better man. And we, Harmony and I, established the only recognized chapter of the Black Panther Party in a prison. And when Officer Miller was found stabbed to death, we became the primary target of the administration and the security people.
Mr. Woodfox, did you have problem with closed-in spaces?
Yeah, I mean, I have problems even now. You know, I still have claustrophobic attacks. If there's a solution for claustrophobic, for me it was the pacing. You know, you get this urge when these attacks first occur. You know, you feel like the atmosphere is closing on you. You feel like the very skin on your body is compressing, and like you feel like you're smothering. So you fight not to panic. You know, I mean, for me that was the key. You know, not to panic. And you know, over the decades, you know, I mean, there have been times, and particularly during the summer months, when I've had attacks, and I've walked up and down my cell, and there were a puddle of water from the front of the cell to the back of the cell from me sweating, you know. Yeah. And you just pace, you know. And there have been times when, you know, the attacks last, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, and there have been times when they last for hours and hours, you know.
Over the years, Brent Miller's widow, Teenie, became convinced you couldn't have been the person who murdered her husband, right?
Yes. When I got out, I had an opportunity to sit down with her and, you know, have dinner and meet with her and her daughter. And, our hearts always did go out to Miss Rogers because, you know, we knew that she was not being told the truth. You know, all of the evidence that pointed to someone else killing Brent Miller, she was never made aware of that, to my understanding. And but once, you know, our investigators and stuff, you know, talk to her and give her all the facts, then on her own, she come to the conclusion that, you know, we had been wrongfully convicted for the death of her husband, you know, mm-hmm. And she became an ardent supporter for our freedom, you know.
This seems like such a naive question, but how are you doing now?
I'm doing okay. You know, I mean, I just celebrated my 72nd birthday and my 3-year anniversary of freedom. You know, as I say, since I've been out, I've been there, and I had an opportunity to speak across America and outside America. And, you know, one of the things that the three of us promised and made a vow to is that when we went free, that we would be the voice and the face of the men and women and children that hidden behind the walls of prisons in this country. So that's, you know, what we are trying to do now. And, of course, we are trying to end the use of solitary. You know, solitary confinement is the most cruel form of torture.
Albert Woodfox's new memoir, Solitary. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 2nd, 2019, so I have been told. If I could make a quick request, if we have listeners, if you could help get contact information for Mr. Jerome Fox. He authored Addicted to Whites. Email, number, anything, Mr. Jerome Fox, non-white, male victim of racism, contact information, much obliged. Thank goodness I am not in Virginia. Wow. Woo! I sympathize with all the folks who are on Eastern Time. Wowee, it was something experiencing this program starting at 9 p.m. I asked repeatedly about the time for this program when we were starting back in 2011. This is our 10-year anniversary. I asked repeatedly, and people said they were fine with the program time. If I lived on the East Coast, I would have given a vigorous, hey, let's see if we can make this thing a little bit earlier. Wow, it is late having this come on at 9 p.m., but I am back. The Friendly Plantation, Seattle, Washington. Whew. So thankful I am not in Virginia. Man, almost died. Compensatory call in, dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. Number one, we did not do the book club because I almost died in Virginia. I did not think I was going to survive, but I made it and I needed some time to recuperate as was planned. I was told in advance that hosting a yoga retreat is kind of an exhausting experience. It was. I needed a little bit more time to recuperate. Really should have probably taken the entire week, but we are here. Book club will be back this Thursday. Since we didn't start, we still have time to make a switch with what we are going to read. We had folks who wrote in about Mumia. I said I think we should read something that Mumia authored. Live from Death Row would be a good choice. Death Blossoms, I read that one. All Things Censored. He's a prolific writer, journalist, victim of white supremacy, Mumia Abu-Jamal. All of that said, someone would have to volunteer to read. I am not going to read. I just read The Man Knot. It wasn't that long ago. We just did the retreat. I have been on the counter-racist grind while still a flood victim. So I'm not going to narrate. So someone would have to be willing to narrate if we're going to do Mumia starting this week. If not, there are other books that we could pick. I had made a choice, but we'll wait and see. I will announce by Tuesday what the new book will be. Next up, Wow. So the cows, 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, we did what turns out looks like will be round one. Now, I said I didn't want to, you know, just do these retreats, even one of them, if it's a waste of time and energy. It took a lot of time to coordinate the event, and then people had to invest a lot of time and energy to come hang out, and then they give up 4 days to hang out in Virginia with Gus T. I mean, wow, it's got to be some value. So just according to what people have reported in the, it hasn't even been a full week since the retreat concluded, we've had one participant who's seriously considering doing yoga teacher training. Several participants have continued with either practicing yoga, practicing plant-based eating, and or both. And we've had one person who has resigned their employment. Now, that may or may not be constructive. We'll have to see. But just looking at the activity that has been reported thus far from people who attended the retreat, if you attended the retreat, you can kind of let us know. In fact, I should have got that on the list for improvements. Journal. We will journal during the retreat and then ask people to journal after the retreat, at least for 30 days. That'll writing and reading more important than watching television. We'll have a homework assignment next time around. Journal during the retreat. And then journal afterwards and see, does it make an impact? Is there even a value to having sustained intimate contact with other Black people where you can talk about racism, white supremacy? Journals. Anyway, we'll see if it's constructive. If you attended the retreat, please let us know if you have any significant events or thoughts that are, you think, connected to in some way being a part of the COWS 2019 10-year anniversary yoga retreat. Directly related, there were a number of people from all over the world who inquired about the yoga retreat. I was very surprised about that. There were a number of people who were on the West Coast who said, we would like a retreat that is not in Virginia, that is something that is driving distance for people who live in California or wherever that is closer to the West Coast. I said, hey, that should be doable. We began looking for dates, locations, all of the above for a second COWS 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, this time on the West Coast. So far, I think there is a location that may work. It is in Southern California. It would be an Airbnb type situation, so we would not have to deal with a host directly. We would be checked in and they would vamoose. We could contact them if we needed assistance. But this time around, we would have a residence all to ourselves, and we would have at least 13 beds, not air mattresses, actual beds for participants to sleep in. I think that was something that was big on the list of recruitments. I think we would have 5 bathrooms. I have to double check, but I think that was how that was one of the parameters that we were checking. 5 bathrooms, 13 beds. We would have ample space. In fact, my vision is that we could do yoga outside. We're in Southern California. What's the point of going to California to stay in the house? So we could do yoga outside. It seems there's ample space. We would be close to an airport. This looks very feasible for the dates that I think I gave before that we were thinking for the summer West Coast yoga retreat, July 3rd through July 7th. We would be in Southern California. I'll send out an email if you are interested. Give the dates again, July 3rd through the 7th. Looking tentatively, Southern California, we'll have to see, you know, if people think this location would work, if it would be easy enough for people to access. We would be willing to hang out here, but it looks like it would be a spot where we could at least everyone could get a comfortable night's rest with it, which I think is a key component of health and wellness, way better than air mattresses that we had at the first retreat. So we could have the seclusion, the intimacy, we could rest comfortably. Madeira
I spoke with her. She would be willing to fly out. She did all of the fantastic plant-based meals for the retreat in Virginia. She said she would be willing to come out to California to cook for us 5 days, 4 nights, untiljustice@gmail.com. We will give the details. I would like to have all of this booked and taken care of before April. We can plan things out way in advance and just relax and have something to look forward to for July. And then again, December 27th, January 1, I'm deliberately picking so-called holidays. December 27th through January 1st for the third Cows 10-year anniversary yoga retreat of the year. That would be in Miami, Florida. I've spoken to a retired firefighter about securing a location. Once we get more details, like I said, I'd like to have both of these. If people are serious and would be interested in participating in one or both of the Cows yoga retreats, plant-based meals every time, yoga every time, discussions, workshops on racism, white supremacy. We'll include workplace racism in the itinerary this time around. That was a key omission on my part, I guess. But if you are interested, untiljustice@gmail.com. I'll send out an email to all the folks who emailed the first time with interest and see if either of these would be of interest this time around. But we will be moving forward to see if we have folks who would be interested seriously in doing two additional retreats before the end of the year. And we'll see if it's constructive and then we can plan it. We already have someone who is looking at Toronto for the summer of 2020. But I mean, that's way in the future. Have to see if it's constructive. But we do have someone who is looking for Black-owned locations in the Toronto area for a Cows yoga retreat, Toronto, summer of 2020. Maybe the problem will be solved by then and we can have a retreat to celebrate. But untiljustice@gmail.com if you are interested. Next, the broadcast, 10 years, our anniversary. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested over the past decade. You are why we have stayed on the air. We now have a subscription button where it could be a monthly investment. People asked about that before. I spent a lot of time speaking with the folks on PayPal, thought I had to figure it out. Turned out I did not. That is one of the benefits, I guess, to having to get a new PayPal account. Now the subscription button is right there. Easy to use. Anyone who inquired about making a monthly subscription to the Cows, there you go. Blog address, racism-notes.blogspot.com, PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and I can get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported the Cows for 10 years. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy, and share the broadcast. We have been under extraordinary attack, disruptions to the archives, iTunes feed, you name it, to keep the Cows from being able to broadcast and people being able to get information that may be helpful towards solving the problem. Share the broadcast with other victims of racism if you think it would help them get a better understanding of white supremacy racism. That's it. Let's see. Few other things. Yoga has taught me so much about racism, white supremacy. I generally, to yoga class, I wear my shirt. Please treat me like I am a white person. I've talked about that for a year now. Now I wear my Cows yoga retreat t-shirt to yoga class. And some of the whites in class, they knew that I had a yoga retreat. Some of them even loaned me mats. They knew we needed yoga mats for the retreat. So I come back several times. I had this happen today. I went to class right before the program went on air. I went to class, a suspected racist white woman. She says, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you." What do we say? "You're under surveillance," because I've been back. I've been taking classes since Tuesday. So that means she missed seeing me last week when I was not there, when I was in Virginia, almost died. I says, "I was, you know, hosting a yoga retreat." And she says, you went to a yoga retreat?" I said, "No, I hosted a yoga retreat." "Oh, my goodness. Wow. How was that?" And so I told her, you know, lots of mud. We got through it and did, you know, six classes. She says, "Was there another instructor? Or did you taught all the classes yourself?" I said, "Did it all myself." She says, "Wow, that is amazing." I said, "Yep, we had plant-based meals and you could just totally." "Nigga did what? Nigga did what?" We've done teacher training classes before, so she's an instructor. And she says, I'm just afraid, you know, I just haven't been doing it. I'm just afraid to get out there and do the teaching. And just, it gets intimidating, but I got to do it. I just got to do it. You've inspired me." There's that word again. I've been saying that for a year and a half now, that word. So she said it. This happened multiple times, even happened multiple times today. That was the second time that I had a white woman, suspected racist. When I said, "I know many whites who have been teaching, some of them for more than a year. They have not hosted a yoga retreat." Just that alone, recognizing like, wow, Gus T that quickly hosted a yoga retreat. Wow. And to see that many whites envious, this nigga has done what? I haven't even done. How did the nigga do? Gotta get on. Cannot believe this. But to see that response has been stunning. Also, the surveillance. Just before the yoga retreat, I had teacher training. During the teacher training, we were performing, I think it was wheel pose. You can look online to see what this looks like. In fact, we were doing camel pose to wheel pose. This is considered like an advanced transition. We didn't do this at the yoga retreat. Didn't want to kill anyone. Very difficult posture. I'd only done this posture one time in the whole year, you know, a little bit more than a year that I've been practicing. So I'm paired up with a white woman and we're talking about this difficult transition, camel to wheel. And she says, "No, I can't do it. I don't have the flex. You need a lot of flexibility in your shoulders and your back, deep back bend to do this posture." And she says, "I don't have that flexibility to do it. I just can't do it." And I said, "I've only done it once. It's a little, you know, intimidating. Feels like you could fall on your head." And she says, "Oh, yeah, I remember the time you did it. Tara did the assist." Now, immediately, and I'm thinking, wow. This is what it means to be white. So to put this in context, her immediately remembering the one time that I did this posture, this conversation was happening the Sunday before the Cows Yoga Retreat. So this is the 17th, February 17th. The one time that I did this posture was in May of 2018. I know this because it was right when I began taking classes at this studio, and the person who did the assist, a pregnant white woman, is no longer teaching. In that time, not only she was pregnant at that time, she's had the baby, she's still out on maternal leave. I think the child is now 6 months old or something. That much time has passed. It's been almost a year. It's been almost a year since I did this pose one time, and I didn't even know her at the time. It's not like we had met. We were not homies going out having coffee or anything after class. Didn't know her from, you know, a stranger. But she's, "Oh, yep, I remember. Tara did this." What does it mean to be white? You are under surveillance at all times. Continuing. I will only say briefly about the bit on reparations that I think Neely Fuller Jr., brilliant as usual, that is folly anytime. And you talk about confusion. I don't even know how you enter into that conversation logically while we're still in a system of racism, white supremacy. The reparations, I mean, you have killed, raped, maimed, racially dislocated, you know, millions of black people just within the last 24 hours alone. That's a conservative estimate in my view. The reparations figure, you know, it would have to be retabulated about every 30 seconds or so. Like, I wouldn't even know how to answer that question if we're going to continue with the abuse. It would just have to be updated reparations, you know, every other year or whatever it is. It doesn't even make logical sense to me while we're still in a system of white supremacy, racism. And further, the fact that this conversation is happening and they're saying that the Democratic presidential candidates are talking about this, it just, for me, further solidifies 4 more years. Put me down. I'd already said that some time ago, but Gus T. Renegade, perfect presidential picks for who's going to win. Trump, 4 more years. That's what it solidifies for me, that this is even coming up as conversation for people who are supposed to be opposing the commander in chief. 4 more years. Never had any doubts about that. But, you know, if this is the folly that you got to talk about to get there, 4 more years. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, that would be great. Just make sure that everyone gets an opportunity to speak. If you have additional questions or thoughts, if you could just wait until everyone has spoken at least once, that would be appreciated. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be grand. Just make sure that we do not have to compete over a lot of unnecessary background noise. If you know you have people talking or in a distracting environment, much obliged. If we could not use metaphors for this broadcast, that would be appreciated. I think you heard some of that in the audio clips. They said that white supremacy racism is in the landscape of America. What are we talking about? Are we talking about cotton? What are we talking about here? What's going on? Be direct. Be explicit. I expect that from racists, to deliberately use language to confuse what racism is, how it works, what it means to be white. That is a tactic of a master deceiver. We, Gus T. included, have been exposed to this sort of conduct, misconduct, for centuries. That has greatly influenced how we communicate. Also, we, victims of racism, are still learning. As such, frequently we will substitute a metaphor, comparison, simile for logic. Often, that just adds to the confusion. If we could be explicit, exact, direct about what it is we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. Again, contact for those who are serious about the retreat. California, July 3rd through July 7th. That is 5 days, 4 nights. Tentatively Southern California, but that is not anything definite. We were looking just in general at locations on the West Coast. But to find a non-white property with 13 beds, at least 5 bathrooms, full bathrooms, whew, it definitely piqued my interest. If you are interested, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we can see if we can do a cow's yoga retreat with no mud, yoga, vegan food, lots of patience and constructive activity with victims of racism, with sunshine indeed. Wowee. Folks who called in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Mortgage banker from Virginia.
Oh, my Lord. Bless your heart. Bless your heart. I'm so sorry that you have to live there. I will pray for you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gus. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Hope everybody's doing well. Unfortunately, I am going to use a metaphor to start off, but I don't even know if it's a bad one. I wanted to talk about Coon Man and Coon Woman. That story that came out about Mrs. Northrum and the tackiness that she did. We do a local radio broadcast, and there was a gentleman that asked questions, and he was a non-white male, black male, and he was talking about forgiveness of Governor Northrum and things of that nature. And when this came out, I just happened to send him a text message, and I asked him, so what are your thoughts on Mrs. Northrum? And he said, I'm trying my best to not believe what you consistently say, which is me, that you should suspect all white people of practicing racism. But he said, unfortunately, I'm coming to the point to where I have to. And I said, hey, that's good. You know, you're a victim of racism. I said, that doesn't mean hating, like Dr. Welsing says. That just means that you need to be aware of how they're practicing racism. Another question that someone had posed to her on a Twitter or something of that nature that I found very interesting was, the next time that you are showing them cotton, why don't you show them the whip you were using as well? And I thought that was very fantastic. In reference to the terrorism story, I just read an article, and I believe it was in the Washington Post. Gus might correct me. And it looked like that was published on February 20th. This is the first time, and I don't watch a lot of news or television, that I've even heard about this story. That article that's in the Washington Post, probably written by a suspected racist, he or she, is very, very good. And when I say very, very good, it's very detailed with information. I was listening to the previous broadcast from 2011 when Gus was interviewing Dr. Welsing, and Andrew Wyvek, I think that's his name, was brought up. And this is who that person, this alleged Coast Guard killer, terrorist, white terrorist, was studying as well. And for all the quote unquote information and interviews that they have black people on television talking about reparations and descendants of slaves, we should be talking about this white killer and terrorist who was planning to start a race war. Why do we have so much information and so much focus on things that are not going to stop the system of white supremacy? And we need to be focusing on people like this, because this guy is man. I mean, if you just read that article and you actually just listen to some of the things that they were saying, and his defense attorney, no less, actually said, hey, you know, we don't necessarily think that this guy is a threat to the community. And during that 14-day bail period, they were actually thinking about letting him go. And just let that sink in. And I appreciate your time, Gus, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. I'm looking at the Washington Post article. The grandsister, Dr. Welsing, she did talk about this on a regular basis. I think I did include her audio to set or to preface this segment, where she talked about fascism, end stage, white supremacy, deliberate. I will post that Washington Post report. But this reminded me of something I mentioned at the retreat. There was a white man who stole a plane in Seattle. This was recently. I mentioned this, and people looked at me and said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, this was major news. This was national news. Certainly it was big news here. It was in the New York Times, CNN. I'm reading the New York Times report. Richard Russell, who stole a plane near Seattle, raises troubling security questions. So you can have those two pieces of information together. The white terrorist, Coast Guard white terrorist, white identity extremist, and then this white male who stole a plane. The story is as bizarre as it is tragic. An airline worker who had no business being in a cockpit somehow took off from a major airport in a turboprop passenger plane Wow, alliteration. Dipped and soared in the skies above the Seattle area and then crashed into an island on Puget Sound. It was all over in about an hour, but the consequences of the unauthorized flight on Friday evening are monumental, aviation experts and investigators said. This is from August of 2018. Like I said, this is real recent. The man, a ground service agent identified as Richard Russell, according to a law enforcement official, exposed a troubling reality of airport security in the post-9/11 era. While many visible aspects of commercial flight that affect the routines of passengers have been hardened, parts of the system that are behind the scenes, but just as important to public safety as cockpit doors and screening machines, remain vulnerable. It goes on to give more details about how he was able to steal this plane, and they did some background information. It seems like he had done this before, been in an unauthorized area in the cockpit of a plane, kept his job. He didn't get fired, furloughed, none of that. And then he steals a plane and gets to fly over a major metropolitan city. Richard Russell, this is what it means to be white. I cannot see a Negro stealing a plane in Seattle, Atlanta, any other major airport this easily and taking it for a joyride. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, if we've missed you totally, line should be open. Oh, my Lord. Everyone hush. I could have died in the state of Virginia were it not for Miss Quick, who helped me escape. And then I could have died. I may have still been at the airport, my corpse there dehydrated, were it not for Princess. Much obliged. Thank you so much for saving my life. So glad I'm out of Virginia. Did you have commentary to share, ma'am? She might not be able to speak presently. Virginia can take your voice away at times. We'll check back in to hear from Princess momentarily. Others who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Thank you for allowing me to share. Hello, everyone. I missed most of the clips. I only had just a couple of things to share. In the Las Vegas Review-Journal, they have a combined Saturday-Sunday edition. It was actually an article about texting and driving. I'm sorry, not texting and driving. It was an article about a law that they're trying to pass. It's called, the article, it says, Police Texting Checks Argued. So basically, they're trying to propose a law that would allow police to scan drivers' phones in a serious crash. But it's a serious or fatal crash, but it doesn't actually detail what serious is. And there are, of course, proponents of it. One of the proponents of the law was someone from New York, or previously from New York, who had lost a son in an accident where the opposite person was a distracted driver. And then there's other people saying, well, you know, this could just basically be like a way for white people to then use this same technology and in an abusive way. So I thought that was interesting, and they named it Textilizer. So even if you don't want to give up your phone, they can basically use this scanning device that it says it's only in the prototype stage, that they would be able to use this device and still be able to scan your phone, which, you know, it's definitely, I know there were some segments a while back talking about how they were trying to get a victim's fingerprint. I think that one of the victims, I think it was a black male who had been shot by police, and they were trying to, at the funeral home, trying to get his fingerprint or what have you to unlock his phone. But if they have this type of technology, you know, they, you know, suspected racist, they'll be able to, you know, just use this technology and not need your fingerprint. So I thought that was interesting. And then, the last thing, it was the last article I just wanted to share. It came out yesterday, and it says DEA raids alleged drug mill recovers enough fentanyl to kill 2 million people. But I thought the most interesting thing was that, I don't know if this is like national news or not. It just kind of popped up on my phone, and then I was researching it more. But all of these people are, quote unquote, Latino, just based on the names. There's Garcia, Mata, Hernandez, Mendoza. Like, those are basically the last names of the four people who were involved in this fentanyl raid. But the main thing is that they're not really pointing out who gave, how did they even get this fentanyl? Because if you trace back the origin of it, it was made by a white scientist in Berlin. And then this also under the names of different pharmaceutical companies. I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Reading is more important than watching television. Dr. Welsing talked about getting the newspaper, being informed, getting information on a regular basis, local, national, global. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. I guess the Dr. Fox person, he was on one of the other shows on VTR, Time for Awakening. I don't have time to listen to the whole thing, but I can send you that, I guess, because he might have said his information during that, and I guess you could hear more of what he said, especially talking to black people who are concerned about black people. So I can, you can find it, or I can send it to you. No big deal. With that, I'm glad you made it out alive. I don't know what happened in Virginia, but yeah, you're free. You know, so to speak, you're out of Virginia. The movie thing, you know, we just don't really need to be that concerned about it. I'm glad the people who wind the wind did, you know, at that point. The work is done. It's all subjective. Does someone like it or not like it? But, you know, congratulations to those who wanted to. And, yes, I can see where the movie that won, I actually did see it. And I saw the other movie where the person was upset that his movie didn't win, you know. And it was weird, the responses from the white people who went. But, oh, and then I had one question. You were talking to, I guess, the white person where you go, I guess your quote, I guess your workplace, because you go to the yoga all the time and you learn how to teach and train, so I guess it's your workplace. And I just wanted to know, like, why do you tell them, like, you went to the retreat and this and that, those type of things happen? I just ask them why, because usually when I go away, whatever, well, before... Well, I should say now, so I go, where did you go? I went away. What did you do stuff? Everything's fine. I try to stick to one word. So I was, you know, asking why you do that.
Well, in this instance, when the person asked me where I was, I actually had the T-shirt on that said Cal's 10-Year Anniversary Yoga Retreat, February 2019. Virginia is for lovers. So... it is a rare moment when someone asks you where you are and you have a T-shirt that you could just point to and say, oh, I was here. That's one. Two, I had mentioned the retreat because I asked some of these people. I had never been on a yoga retreat before, nor had I hosted a yoga retreat before. So I had lots of ignorance. Many of these people have been to yoga retreats and or have hosted yoga retreats. So I asked them when I knew I was going to plan the event. So several of them knew just because I had come to them to get information and even yoga mats. As I said, some of them donated yoga mats too. Yeah, once it was to the point where I had to share, I've said that before, if you got to share with one person, it's no secret. So, you know, I was sharing, trying to get information for this one, no secrets, and I wear my T-shirt. So, you know, no secrets on the yoga retreat. That's public information.
No, okay, that makes sense. That sounds like you're doing research, so, and follow up with the research. That makes sense. I was just asking, you know, read your cues, you know, do what you want. I was just asking.
That's legit. That's logical. Try to give as little information as possible. Absolutely. I think that's a strategy we recommend frequently on workplace racism. And this is basically like a workplace environment. So absolutely. Solid logic. Great question.
And I'll send you I think there's a clip for Dr. Fox, the Addicted to White's book. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yeah, he was on that show. So I haven't found the email address because he's not affiliated with a school, even though he's Dr. Fox. So I haven't seen him with a school, but I think he is in practice. So I don't see a practice yet either, but I'm still on it.
Much obliged.
That'll work. I'm still looking.
Thank you. That's self-correct. We are all still learning, trying the best we can. I appreciate you investing some time and energy to get that information. Much obliged. Let's see. Other folks, if you have commentary, suggestions, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, proceed. Folks are lollygagging, not sure if they're taking time to get into a spot where they can speak or they just need a few moments to get their thoughts together.
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. Let's see. We'll get retired firefighter. Give us 1 second. Other caller who spoke up. Yes, gotcha. Other caller who spoke up.
Well, thank you both. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers as well as the listeners. This is in Yame in Nebraska. I wanted to share, the last caller spoke on I think she was referring to the Academy Awards, the Oscars ceremony, the film that won Best Picture. There was a lot of talk about it. The director, Spike Lee, he made comments about it, because, you know, his picture Black Klansman didn't win, but, also I noticed that film is supposed to be about, the relationship between a so-called friendship between, a victim and, his suspected racist driver. And I seen the film and, it was pretty tacky, you know, tacky, trashy. And, but I did notice in the film, it's supposed to be a biographical picture, and it made it seem like it centered around the, victim, but, the film was more about the suspected racist. And, but when they mentioned the victim a few times, they alluded to him being involved in anti-sexual tragic arrangement as well. And I was thinking that, isn't this the second year in a row where the Best Picture Academy Awards involved a non-white male involved in a anti-sexual relationship? And it also happened that there was another victim, non-white male, he was recognized, I guess, as being the best dressed, and he wore a tuxedo gown sort of ensemble. And, you know, the picture has been going around a lot on social media, and he's also involved in a anti-sexual tragic arrangement. So I just thought that was I thought that was interesting. It seemed like they're really pushing that whole agenda. And I was wondering if anyone had caught I would have said it was a trial, but it was okay, Princess. The trial of Michael Cohen, the former private attorney for the President Donald Trump. Yeah, he testified to Donald Trump to being as far as being a racist, and there was a representative. I think his name was Mark Meadows. He actually brought out a non-white female, a black woman, had her stand there and read a statement from her contradicting what the lawyer testified to. Basically, he was racially showcasing this non-white woman, saying that Donald Trump couldn't be racist because he hired her, and he has a statement from this black woman saying Donald Trump's not racist. So obviously he's not racist. But then another representative, she pointed out that he was using this black woman as a prop and saying that in itself is a racist act. Well, that was a little going back and forth, a little argument between those two. And it ended up with the, I don't know how you, the committee leader, Elijah Cummings, he was sitting over the proceedings. So, yeah, it ended with Elijah Cummings and this other non-white woman apologizing to the white male when she pointed out he committed a racist act. He defended himself. He racially showcased. He said he had nieces and nephews who were non-white and things like that. But it ended with the non-white people apologizing to him if they hurt his feelings by stating not that he was a racist, but that he committed racist acts. And yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for letting me share. And I'll mute my line.
Wow. What to say? I thought I heard young voices in the background. Counter-racist parenting, super important. Wow, talk about time and energy. Yeah, and that's what I mean. We have so many things that are important. If you are an attempted parent, that is a lot of time and energy. You don't have time to waste if you're not getting constructive information from the cows. That being said, when you mentioned the pattern about anti-sexual behavior, significant. You'll see a lot of those patterns with the entertainment portion of white supremacy racism. However, I have consistently said, not for a decade, but for some years, we don't talk about Area 8 on the compensatory call-in because people get very fascinated with Area 8, so-called interracial relationships. I have noted a pattern that frequently, and I've also said we don't talk about area, I don't know the number, but entertainment, because people also get very fascinated with, you know, the films and television. People watch a lot of television, unfortunately. Those two, there's a strong correlation. I found that generally when you bring up one, the other will follow, that the entertainment just invariably goes towards so-called tragic arrangements with entertainment, whether it's who the actual plot of the story or who the so-called actors, who they are actually sleeping with and that sort of thing. But there is a reason why we do not focus a whole lot of time and energy on the compensatory call-in can get to us. It can become a big distraction, I found. But the important pattern about the anti-sexual behavior, but this is the compensatory call-in, Area 8, entertainment. Not our focus today. Other focus, retired firefighter. Thank you for your patience, sir. Did you have commentary?
Yes. I was trying to figure out on what I was going to report for this week, but by listening to the reports that you play before the program gets started. Well, actually, that's the start of the program. It's your the recordings, the reports, and I was paying attention to the one about the I believe the Angola three, the three Black Panther Party members who had been in prison for decades. One of them reported that about the torture, the form of torture, solitary confinement. And I could almost feel on what he was saying because in the profession that I worked at until retirement, that actually is a frequent situation that firefighters get into, confined spaces. Although I myself personally, I've never been into quote unquote greater confinement, but I've been in confined spaces and, you know, dangerous situations that are called fires. I was just thinking about what he was talking about, that form of torture. And, I must say, even from my little small experiences, on fires and also, in training, the fire department has this trailer. Just imagine a trailer. They would bring it out, to a site, and, we would one by one go through a confusing trail through this trailer. First of all, you would have to go get up, climb on top of this trailer, and go through a hatch. It's totally dark. Just, in other words, close your eyes tight and put your hands over your eyes, and have somebody else to put their hands over your hands. And that's what it looks like inside of this trailer. And that's what the same thing looks like in a real fire also. And noise where you can't really communicate with another person. And the confinement is very tight. You can almost feel it. You can almost feel it. The confinement, you can almost feel it. It's so strong. Matter of fact, Huey P. Newton, when he was arrested for the murder of the enforcement official in Oakland, I think in he was put in Alameda County Jail, and they had a nickname for that particular cell that he was put in called, it was called the Soul Breaker. In other words, they would put an inmate into this confined space. And within about maybe five minutes to 10 minutes, you would hear that person screaming and hollering and crying to please let me out of it. I have a level of claustrophobia, but in the situation, I guess I was able to deal with the fear of it enough to get the job done, that sort of thing. But I was kind of like identifying with the person in the story that had the recording of, and about how I can see where that would be considered to be a vast and powerful means of torturing people, where most people that probably either that haven't been into that situation in greater confinement or in some other kind of means have not really faced with it. Have been, you know, have dealt with it. It is. It's very torturous from a mental standpoint. Matter of fact, the black female, I can't think of her name right now, who was found hanging from, quote unquote, they said, was found hanging in her cell. What was her name?
Sandra Bland.
Yes. I would assume that she was placed into that situation at some point in time, because I did see a documentary that had the cell where she was in, and just a lot of these little small jails where they be locking people up into it promotes claustrophobia in itself, you know, and they purposely slam the doors, you know, to give some sort of finality of where you're at, and psychologically you think that nobody actually is. You know, once you hear those doors slam, that they're going to forget that you're even there, that sort of thing. So I can see where she probably was tortured in that way also, because some people can tolerate it more than others. I put it that way, have more of a threshold of that type of torture, more so than others, and I would assume that hers was probably, you know, very short, you know, as far as that concerns. So that's basically what my report was, is that that particular segment of the program and how the Black Panther member, how he was tortured. And he expressed that torture as probably being the worst torture that you can face in greater confinement. And that's all I'd say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. In terms of solitary confinement, racist, when Dr. Kanban, he talks about racists as being scientific terrorists. In the documentary, and that's interesting because you said that you saw that in the documentary that they called it the Soul Breaker. In the documentary on Khalif Browder, they called it the Bing, right? And they got and they used this metaphor specifically as a descriptor because they said that's the sound that your brain would make as you go insane in this, you know, little box that they put you in. This is the Khalif, the documentary that Jay-Z was involved with. And so I point that out to say this is not by accident. They've been doing this scientifically, probably refining how they make these little boxes so that they totally destroy Black people. So it's no accident that you have something like Khalif Browder. This has been planned for decades and how they construct. You have white supremacist architectures, Thomas Jefferson, raping racist, renowned architecture. This is what they do. Build pens for Negroes. So not a surprise. They enjoy that sort of thing. I could see them, you know, oh yeah, well, maybe we will do away with solitary confinement. Maybe we'll think about it. That's what I said about the reparations. Just, it's not logical in a system of white terrorism. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you completely, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Someone recommended Sundown Towns as a book. That was a book I was going to pick for the book club. James Lowen, Suspected Race Soldier. I thought that would be a good one. Sundown Towns. I would be with that one. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, proceed. While we're waiting for folks who have their hands up, I guess either to get to a location where they can speak or get their ideas together to share, we should be back. As I said, with the book club, I'll announce by Tuesday what the new book will be, and then things will be back on a regular schedule this week. I'll have my rest together and I will send out. I will be able to update. I know folks were disgruntled about the archives. We will get all of the archives uploaded. There's no broadcast tomorrow, no traveling. I can take Sunday to just upload, and I'll post links on social media sites so that folks can access the archives to all of the broadcasts that we have held over the past week or so. Wow, it has been lots. Lots and lots to get done and more to do. That is the system of racism, white supremacy, keeping us active, hopefully active and engaged in constructive behavior. Folks that dialed in with a hand up, do you all still need a moment or ready to share?
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I know you're feeling. When I went to Vegas, I was so thrown off by the time. I don't think I slept until I came back to New York because it was like, it's late. My body's telling me it's late, but the time on the clock is saying it's still early. You know, it was like very difficult. Dr. Kerry Mann, Not Moment, 10-year-old black child watches his, a 10-year-old white child for his grown black father, a boy. I thought that was very interesting. And immediately that book popped in my head. Not Allowed to Be a Man. The Canadian hockey player. This week, I watched, saw something come up on the Google News. It was talking about an incident with an NBA player named Russell Westbrook. And he was playing in a game and against the Denver Nuggets. Playing on the road, and, you know, the crowd was real intense, and the call went against him. And, you know, he kind of looked upset. And you see a little white boy just come out of nowhere and shove him in the back. And he went and whispered something in that child's father's ear, pretty much telling him, you know, your kids, you know, watch your kids, you know. But nonetheless, he said that the child hit him, so I have to take his word for him. He felt it, not me. It looked like a shove, but just the audacity of these white people at these games, when the emotions are high, they just, you know, they become fanatics for real. Logic is on point as far as reparations go, as far as I'm concerned. First, why don't we talk about stopping practicing racism, and then we could talk about some reprisals. But first, why don't y'all stop? You know, yeah. So I think that that's a very good thing. Dr. Welding moment. Last week, I spoke about the Samsung phone being able to read your fingerprint as it's getting close to it before you even touch it. Ultrasonically reading your aura. Another feature to the Samsung phone's camera, which is an AI camera, it has a Samsung beauty mode and allows you to make your selfie. You can augment it in real time. So while you're looking at yourself in the camera, you can make your lips thinner or larger, your nose thinner or larger, your cheeks more in or out. Your chin, larger, smaller, and you can also alter your eyes, even, I think, change your color. And you can preset it so that every time you take a selfie of yourself, those presets automatically overlay the actual image. Dr. Welsden always said if she had a pill for people to, you know, do certain things, this technology that's coming out, pretty soon you'll be able to lighten your skin color and probably straighten your hair as well. And that'll just be it. Another technology bit, Huawei, just spelled Huawei, and a couple other Chinese makers, but they're the biggest one. They have a time of flight camera in their phone, which shoots light at you. And based off of the time that the light takes to come back to the phone, they're able to give a 3D imprint of your face. And from that 3D imprint with the actual picture that you took, your selfie, it'll put that over the 3D image, and it allows you to pretty much get a 3D makeout of your face, and you can even turn it around and see the side view. So more cameras doing augmented reality, able to cause a lot of confusion, especially as you know, we're the most surveilled people. So we're probably on these court cameras more than anyone, and now they can augment certain parts of the footage to make anything look possible. So that's coming. We're entering a new phase of white supremacy. Here in the U.S., it's going to be called surveillance capitalism. In China, a socialist country, they call it social credit. In India, they're calling it e-governance. In the U.K., most recently, they've called it automating inequality. Very interesting. Last year, China banned 23 million people from traveling due to their poor social credit scores. 17.5 million of those 23 million people were stopped for buying airplane tickets. 5.5 million from hopping on trains, 290,000 people were stopped from getting a higher-paying senior management job. 128 people couldn't leave the country at all due to them not paying their taxes. This is where they're heading. Now, in the U.S., we have 300 million people. And based off of the rate of China with 1.5 billion people, that would be about 4.6 million people here in the U.S. that would be on this social credit punishment. Just looking at the disproportionate number of blacks in prison, is upwards in some stats of 40%. 40% of that 4.6 million people would be mean that 1.9 million black people wouldn't be able to get a better paying job, wouldn't be able to catch a flight, wouldn't be able to get on the train, which could also cause you to lose your job. Just terrible. And even when you look at that stat and you add into the fact that United States has 655 people per 100,000 people in prison, and China only has 145 people out of 100,000 people. So it'll really look more like 21 million Americans would be on the social credit list. And 8.4 of those people would be black. That would be out of the 40 million of us. So that's a huge statistic. And this is definitely going to change the way they practice racism, using the surveillance tactics and pretty much holding things that poverty creates against you. I mute my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged. The language, automating inequality, that's part of the refinement. I think you talked about that a lot, that they'll have the racism, white supremacy will continue. It'll just be in the apps that racists have programmed. And then, oh, yeah, it's not racism. It's just automated inequality. Yes. Other folks who dialed in, context of white supremacy, *61, if you have commentary. Anybody that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed. Have we nabbed everyone who has a hand up, or are we still missing a few folks? I'll assume we got everyone for the time being. If you have commentary, questions, *61, we will add you to the line. Now, in addition to R. Kelly, Bill Cosby, further confirmation of Dylan Storm Roof, Dr. Welsing talked about that. Now, Michael Jackson with all of the hoopla around the new documentary film. I guess that's going to be the new one. They had the R. Kelly documentary, and now they have the one with Michael Jackson, that he's some sort of sexual predator. I thought, again, the man, not Dr. Tommy J. Curry. I guess it'll be, I wouldn't be surprised if it's President Obama, any prominent black person is going to be facing these accusations. I even thought when they mentioned Driving Miss Daisy, that Spike Lee, I guess, Do the Right Thing lost out when Driving Miss Daisy. Morgan Freeman, wasn't he just facing allegations? It'll be any black male. You won't be able to mention any black male without being saying, oh, yeah, but he did, you know, get those shame what he did. Yeah, he did, you know. It'll be any and all black males of any prominence who have done anything even remotely constructive. That'll be the first thing that you think of, not, you know, whatever other constructive things that they attempted to do with their time and energy. Any folks, I haven't even seen it, the Michael Jackson film. Has anyone seen the documentary? I reckon it might not be out. I'm not even sure.
The only thing I've seen is the interview with the with his brothers.
Okay.
And I really haven't paid attention to it, but I did notice that they were interviewing at least three of the brothers.
Let's see. Irie in Louisiana, did you have commentary, ma'am? You should be with us.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, I do. It's really quick. I haven't really been able to keep up with the show. Been very busy, but I heard the broadcast with, I can't remember her name, the lady that was giving education on vegan
Dr. Lathan. Dr. Lathan.
Dr. Lathan, yes. And it was great. It actually, I made a deal with myself to go vegan after Mardi Gras Day for life, not for a season, but for life. And I heard her mention a book that I wanted to impart on all of you that talked about the importance of hydration and health. The name of the book is You're Not Sick, You're Thirsty. I don't remember the name of the author, but that is the name of the book I do believe she was referencing. And, you know, of course, check with her to make sure that is it. But I specifically had just read a passage about dehydration and sciatic nerve conditions and vertebrae and misbehaving because of dehydration, along with a sundry of other things. And that's it. I'll mute the line. I hope everyone has a good weekend, a good night, and I'll listen to the rest of the podcast. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Wow. That is amazing. I'm so glad to hear. She wasn't even at the retreat and going vegan. That was what we talked about the whole time at the Cal's 10-year anniversary yoga retreat. That right there being the act of racism, that right there being the protest that I'm going to eat correctly and not digest voluntarily all these poisons that whites dump on us. And they do dump a lot in Louisiana. They don't have the Cheetos chicken sandwich down there, but they got all kinds of nonsense, pork and toxic non-food items that they shovel on black people. So that is enormous. I'm so thankful to hear that. if there's anything that we can do, folks from the retreat emailed me today to get some of the recipes from the chefs who prepared just phenomenal plant-based meals for us the entire time we were in Virginia. Even though I almost died, I had great food the entire time I was there. Outstanding to hear. I hope more Cal's listeners make that transition, get more vegetables, fruits, less meat products, dairy products, just all the poisons that totally sap your vitality and ability, strength to solve the problem. Dr. Welsing talked about that. Think of that as black self-respect, eating correctly, taking care of yourself so that you can have maximum strength, maximum power to solve the problem. That's universal man, universal woman, taking care of yourself, eating correctly. Other folks who dialed in. The book, You're Not Sick, You're Thirsty. Maybe we should read that on the book club. It's that's the book. You'll just have to look. It's a difficult last name, but You're Not Sick, You're Thirsty. Reading is more important than watching television. Maybe we should read that on the book club. If there's no audiobook, if we have anyone who'd be down to volunteer to read, that would be awesome. Other folks, if we have folks that we missed completely, if you dialed in, if you have commentary to share, speak up. I'll look for other hands on the switchboard as well. The caller at 6260. Did you have commentary? 6260.
Oh, yes. This is Jasmine. Hi, Jasmine. Guest. What happened to make you almost die, Gus, in Virginia? You almost got land based blasted by a mudslide or something?
It was just very traumatic. I mean, I didn't even tell you all about all of the trauma in my Virginia experience. I think you all just got like a little bit here. We were stuck in a ditch. I said, Princess saved my life. We were stuck in a ditch at 3 o'clock in the morning, in the rain, mm-hmm. in desolate Druryville, Virginia, where I think several people said that they felt like a Klansman could run out. We're in the state of the Coon Man, mm-hmm. like felt that a Klansman could run out any moment. We had to call a tow truck at 3 o'clock in the morning in a ditch in the rain in Virginia, where none of us were residents. And the white tow truck driver said that he would be forced to call the state police to come and bear witness to him extracting the vehicle from the ditch. So this happened after I left the airport, not, days into the trip. This was my welcome to Virginia from the airport. Now, that's just one that I hadn't even shared. And I have a long list. I thought I was going to die in Virginia. I'm never going back to Virginia again, ever.
Wow. I'm sorry you had to go through that experience. The trauma, like you said, the trauma, that stuff that sticks with us, I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad, you didn't see any of those little dudes either, I'm glad you're doing well. But in regards to the Bill Cosby, Michael Jackson, and all of the others, it's like, it's, to me, it's very evident that, they have waged a war on black males. It's just blatant, they're just, like you said, I agree with you totally. They're just going after prominent black men. And it's like, if you have done anything constructive, anything positive, what they're doing is they're using tactics to smear these men, to make them look like they're, the stereotype rapist, the rapist, or just, savages. And I see that it's just really blatant the way they're doing this. I'm looking at my screen now. Bill Cosby, to add insult to injury, Bill Cosby will be disposed by one of his alleged sexual assault victims while he is behind bars, a report said Thursday. By, what's her name, Chello Boyne? She's going to, she was the first accused, disgraced comedian in 2016 of drugging and sexually abusing her during a party at the Playboy Mansion in 2008 when she was 18 years old. A Los Angeles judge has now granted Boyne's request to take Cosby's disposition as a part of her ongoing lawsuit, The Blast reported. The judge said that Cosby failed to provide good cause as to why it should not go forward. The disposition, which Boyne's attorneys requested to be recorded by a court stenographer and on video, was expected to last 2 days, the media outlet reported. So they're going to, accusers are going to be able to go into the jail or the prison and to do a disposition to, I guess add more charges to him, to his sentence or what have you. So, I don't know. They're just really, I guess he's never going to get out of prison. So I wasn't sure if you heard about that. It was on MSN News, and I just I read it. I think it was yesterday. So I just wanted to report that. And also, as far as the civilians, I do believe, and I really believe that is a new form of technology. It's a new form of racism. They've been using technology to practice racism. And yes, we are being surveilled. And it's just another refined way for them to practice racism. And they do. They get a kick out of and they enjoy torturing and torturing us. And, they think it's really funny and they sit back and they laugh and, kiki about it. Like it's really a joke to them. They don't have any type of compassion or feelings for us. So, that's all I have to share, Jess. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged, Raptomania. I will, ask if we have any callers that are in the New York area. I was thinking black females, but I guess
Yeah, I was thinking black females, but I reckon if anybody. But if you think those laws that they enacted about protecting black employees from having to straighten their hair or they can't have locks, cornrows, whatever it is, do you think that will actually be enforced? Is that actually going to make a difference? I reckon I'll ask that again for workplace racism, but that was one thing I was curious about. If there are other folks who have comments, questions, suggestions they would like to share, we have less than 30 minutes. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Any folks that we missed totally, I'll check first. And then if we have any folks that are in the New York area, if you think that'll really be applied to your workplace, like are they going to change policy and procedure or make sure you got locks, you're protected, you have cornrows, you're protected, nobody's going to say anything to you about being unprofessional. In fact, I would even, I guess I'll ask if we have time, if anybody has the word guide and it's not too much bother. Is kink in the word guide? I believe, or kinky? I think it is. I am alert to the term more so now. I've never been an advocate of it. I don't, you know, tell people not to use it, but I generally don't use it to refer to hair. Most of the time when I hear the term used, it is not in a positive manner. I hear it frequently in yoga class at the beginning of class when they'll say, let's stretch and get out the kinks. And they're not talking about hair. They're just talking about if you, you know, are stiff in a certain part of your body. But get out the kinks. Get out the kinks. That's generally the way that I hear them discussed. So I don't use the term, but if anybody has the word guide and it's close, kinky or kink, that would be, if we have time, not, you know, necessary. If we have any folks that we missed totally, if you have a comment that you want to get in before the end of the broadcast, or if we have any folks who actually do live in the New York area and you think, you know, this hair law is going to be helpful to you as a black person or not helpful, I would be curious to hear your thoughts.
Can I be heard, Gus?
Thomas in New York.
I don't have the word guy, but I looked up kink in the Webster 1828 dictionary, and it says a twist of a rope or thread, occasionally by spontaneous winding of the rope or thread when doubled. That is, by an effort of hard twisting rope to untwist, they wind about one another. So, yeah, that's kink. As far as the hair policy, I've never seen hair really come up in New York. I see people dressed in suits with cornrows and with locks and all different types of hair styles on the train. So I can see that maybe white supremacists just said, you know, we're going to just give them their haircut and the hairstyles they want. That's my opinion on that stuff.
I thought Mayor de Blasio's wife, I think she has locks. She's had locks, I think, the times that I've seen her anyway. And his son prominently featured with an afro. So, I mean, most larger cities, Atlanta, New York, that I've been in, that seems to be the case. I'm not sure. I'll have to hear from some other people to see if they think that that will aid black people in the New York area on the job or not aid or won't be of any impact at all. Person that dialed in might be a Bay Area caller, maybe someone who can make it to the Southern California retreat if we go with that location. California caller, you should be with us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Okay, sure. That sounds fun. I couldn't make it with the one you just did because it's so far. I have the word guide and kink is not in there, but kinky hair and kinky sex is. And do you want me to read it, or did you just want to know?
Oh, sure. If you have it, you know, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. Okay, it says, do not use these words to apply to anything that a person is, has, says, or does. When others use the word kinky to apply to a person, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Ask questions. And then it says, question. What exactly is kink when applied to a person? Why is some hair called kinky, but an elbow is not? Is it because someone said that an elbow is natural, but that a kink in a person's hair is not natural? Is a bend the same as a length? A kink? Excuse me. Is a curl superior to a kink? Is an angle the same as a kink? So, yeah. So it's in there, and it says, no, don't use it when it. Okay. So that's all.
Much obliged. Thank you for reading. That's what I said. I don't tell people not to use it, but that is my general sense. When the term is used, it's not in a constructive manner, especially when associated with Black people's hair. But just in general, it's, you know, get rid of the kinks. We got to straighten it out. Get rid of the kinks. Heard that on the audio segment as well. Other folks, much obliged for the reading, ma'am. Other folks who dialed in, if we have anybody that we missed totally, or if you have commentary on what's been shared thus far, line should be open. We have less than 30 minutes. Or the caller at 9029. Did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers, listeners. Gus, thank you again for the platform. Based out of New York area, and obviously I don't think this law is going to do too much. We already know pretty much how corporate America works, and in regards to these, they'll always find a way, racist white supremacists tend to. But the other question, I have a question in regards to the recent movement that has been started. It's not really that recent, but they're giving it another name, and it deals with the reparations segment that you had. And it's they call it African Descendants of Slavery, ADOS. And this is to the callers as well, listeners too. Do you think that this may cause divide among so-called African Americans that have been here and other ones that have migrated to the country? Because I'm sensing there may be some kind of conflict in that regard. As who would be able to, let's say, best case scenario, people were actually given some kind of reparations, which that's a whole nother topic. But do you think it causes a little bit of more confusion along those lines? Also, you had a real good podcast in regards to health, and this was in regards to sugar. And the book was called Sugar Blues by William Dasty. A gentleman came on the cows. It's an old podcast. I was listening to of yours. His name, I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly, Mbawi Aja Ishangi. Really good book that he suggested about sugar blues. And that's just one of the things that I personally am trying to work on as far as getting off of. I think it's one of the most dangerous drugs I think we don't have any limitations on. That being said, I'll mute my line. Thank you for your time.
Oh, yeah, we did that. Mbwebe Ashanti, he was on the broadcast. I think that's 2011. It's been a decade. Might be odd. Pretty sure that's 2011, though. Sugar Blues, we did read book club on that. That we didn't even have a book club at the time, and we still did a book club on Sugar Blues back in 2011. Lots in the archives. Cow's decade, for sure. William Dufty, actually, is his name. D-U-F-T-Y. D-U-F-T-Y. Sugar Blues. That can be your form of protest. They dump a lot of that refined sugar on black people in a variety of forms. That right there can be your form of protest, counter-racism. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, if we've missed you totally, or if you have additional comments that you want to make sure you get in, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, I have a question for you. Where do I go if I wanted to donate to you? Because I'm on Black Talk Radio, but that it's not there, is it? Is it another one specifically for you?
If you go to racism-notes.blogspot.com.
Wait a second. I'm going to type it in now.
racism-notes.blogspot.com. Go to the blog. Look in the top right corner. You'll see the PayPal button. Bing. There you go.
Okay, I got you. Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Much obliged. Listener-supported counter-racist radio, a decade of broadcasting. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported. Again, you can hit the Amazon wish list as well. Linked at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. Thank you kindly to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list. A decade. I hope we have been worthy of your time and energy. Other folks that we missed completely, or if you have additional comments, questions, suggestions that you want to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to respond to the gentleman that spoke on the reparations and if it would cause a divide between, I guess, the black people that are here versus the ones in other places. I think, and if it will cause confusion, I think everything that they're bringing up as far as racism is, reparations, is to confuse us. And it just caused confusion because everyone that speaks on it, even when black people are given a platform to speak on it, the way they talk about it, they just use words to confuse you and they just go in circles. So it seems like whatever they're going to do, even whatever they're offering to put up out, I guess it's a study for just a study reparation. So it's just wordplay just to play games because they're not going to ever give us any kind of repair. They're including everybody, anybody, everything. And so I think everybody might, that's a good idea, you know, but it's like for everybody. So we'll still get pushed out. That's just my thought on that. I just think it's designed to make sure we're confused, let alone separated. We're already separated. So I think it's just to make sure everybody's confused and to make sure that it's like, oh, you weren't the only one damaged to take away from the actual torture that we went through. Okay, and that's all, and I'll meet my line. Oh, and the boy, he made it back safely. So, and thanks for communicating with them, too. Okay, I'll meet my line.
Oh, very glad to hear that. That's wonderful.
You heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California, in the Koreatown neighborhood. And I wanted to say, in response to all of the discussion about greater confinement and solitary confinement, I have been in a level of confinement that was referred to as the hole. Some years ago, I guess this would be about, I think this was maybe when I was 19, so
maybe 10 years ago. I was in greater confinement, and I had made such a fuss and such a ruckus while in the area that they call holding. And then I made such a ruckus in the area that they call the court. And then I made such a ruckus in the area that they called the transport that they declared that I was what they called crazy. And then they put me into the hole. And then while I was in the hole, I have to say that the only thing I could hear were other inmates, the chatter of other inmates, you know, just yelling back and forth, or, you know, screaming into the nothingness that was, I guess, on the other side, because you couldn't really see anybody else. You could just only hear them. And I guess some of the activities that was going on in there were shaking your door. And the doors were extremely heavy, and I was terrified at the thought that anybody could move the doors in these cells so rigorously that, you know, it made noise and it could rattle. I was very surprised that somebody could move this. And I'm not a weak person. I lift, and, you know, I'm in the gym and everything like that. And no, there's no way that I could have I could have moved the door at that time. And yeah, it was very terrifying. People just having very predatory conversations, people trying to figure out things about the people who they're around and everything like that. And then another thing that they were doing was passing around Good Housekeeping magazines. What was that? Sears catalogs. Martha Stewart Living was also being passed around, and that was it wasn't for the reading, but it was for the pictures. It was the only thing that you were allowed to look at that, you know, had pictures of women in there. So that was how they, you know, occupied their time. That was a little bit of time for me. It wasn't long. I don't know exactly how long I was in there, because they make it so that you don't know how much time you spent in there. But maybe like a day and some change. Maybe 2 days. I don't know. I have no idea, because I was moved to regular population once I chilled out and stopped trying to assert my rights and everything like that. So that was my experience in greater confinement. In the greater confinement that they call solitary confinement, or the hole, in the particular plantation that I was housed in. What was the previous caller? What did they comment on? I forgot.
Conflict being created with reparations between Black people that
were born. Oh, yeah. You know, there's something that's interesting that I'm noting with the ADOS discussion that's going on. If you study some of the things that some of the feelings and the emotions that are being felt by the people that are espousing some version of this discussion online, it's very similar to the type of feeling that, or the type of attitudes that were expressed by South Africans who were incensed to attack other Africans as foreigners in the area known as South Africa. And these attacks rendered the white South African population untouched. However, there were several clashes between the so-called domestic population of South Africans and the so-called immigrant populations of South Africans. And it's very funny for foreign. Sorry, because in that part of the region or that part of the world, non-white people who are not native to the area are called foreigners. I believe the white people who are in those areas from different parts of the world, they're called expatriates. Yeah, it's just very similar to the attitudes that rendered the native population, or that incensed the native population, or portions of the native population, to attack portions of the so-called foreign population that was in the region. And and they were also blaming these non-native black people to the area for unemployment. They were blaming them for loss of revenue and businesses. They were blaming them for just a whole host of issues that could have that could easily be more attributed to the people who are creating the problem, the white supremacists. So I'm just concerned that that the attitudes by this ABOS movement might be used by white supremacists to create more hostilities between different populations of non-white peoples classified as black. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Anything racists are involved with, it is to create more confusion, especially conflict between non-white people. Any other folks that we missed totally, had a commentary they wanted to make sure they get in? we have less than 10 minutes left in the broadcast. Comments? Any final comments? Questions? Get my Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus, again. I've been looking into the so-called DOS movement for a couple years now, following a couple of the people that's been pushing that thing on YouTube, and I'm not a fan of all of their commentary, but some of their commentary I think is destructive. However, I found out recently from Imran DC, of all people, who's a beacon of knowledge, and he told me that there's a group in the area of the United States he lives in called Descendants of American Slavery, and he's tying those two groups together, and a lot of the same talking points. In fact, they're having a convention in this area where this group was founded. So I'm starting to think that these two things might be the same thing. The Descendants of American Slavery is a political party, which, I'm an advocate that we shouldn't be doing politics. So what I did like about the Descendants of Americans, of the American Descendants, the ADOS, was they were trying to get politicians to make commitments. And I said, well, they'll never be able to do that. So I was just waiting for them to get no politicians to get any commitments and to shy away from voting, but it doesn't seem that way. But the one thing that I do like about their group is that they do put a division. I wouldn't even call it a division. It gives a designation to Americans from the United States and Americans who have migrated to the United States. In my opinion, that's very important, because we're not the same people. One group of people gets to come and play. We have a unequal cultural appropriation, in my opinion. So black people in America want to be Africans, and black people in Africa come here and they get to be Americans. The Africans that the black people in America want to be died thousands of years ago. So you're talking about, you want to be something that doesn't even exist anymore. And while people are coming here, getting to, 40% of the Ivy League schools are now non-black Americans, so it's non-black, but people call black people, not people that were from here. So I just think that it's very good to have that conversation, because there does have to be something that divides us, because it's too much confusion with us all being black, because everyone doesn't have the same history. Everyone doesn't have the same fight here, the same causes. We have totally different mindsets.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I certainly don't think all the black people that were born in the States have a similar mind state. But anywho, we will. Yeah, we have the last few moments. The only thing I'll say is that same thing I said before, anytime racists are involved with something, if they're bringing it up, regardless of what it is, they're doing it to strengthen the system of racism, white supremacy. And I could not imagine any time in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, whites doling out resources of any sort to black people, victims of white supremacy, and saying, oh, our bad, here you go. This is to make up for, you know, all that stuff, you know. I cannot imagine that happening. If it did happen, I would expect Donald Sterling to be at the front of the line for, you know, a check for whatever mistreatment he says he has encountered as a Negro. And I would expect lots of squabbling and bickering amongst victims of racism while they wait for whatever is allegedly going to be given. That's the main thing I would expect. Not constructive resources, not a check, not any of that. It would be someone like Elizabeth Warren talking about how she also should get. And in fact, that's reparations. Elizabeth Warren, 2020. That's reparations. Go vote. Elizabeth Warren will get Donald Trump out, and that'll be our reparations. That's about what I would expect from the dialogue and lots of conflict between non-white people, victims of racism. We will be here for the book club. In fact, I was even thinking we could read that book about water. Give the title again, Water, for Health, for Healing, for Life. You're not sick, you're thirsty. Someone would have to be willing to narrate. I don't think there's an audiobook, but I will double check to be certain. James Lowen, Sundown Towns, also suggested there is already an audiobook for that, so we'll have to see what we will be starting this coming Thursday. Reading more important than watching television. That's it. We will wrap the broadcast. Much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Again, so thankful to hear folks who are being more mindful about what they eat. That is counter-racism. That is black self-respect. Just not eating all of the toxins and poisons that whites deliberately dump on us. Let's try as best we can to take care of ourselves, exercise, so that we have the vitality, power to solve the problem. That said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can think of new concepts, solutions to permanently replace white supremacy with justice. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. So glad to not be in Virginia. Night all.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.